This is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory materials in the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC online guidance, Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance. This is a technical and regulatory web-based guidance document. We're going to introduce you to it during today's class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. Our course today is 2.25 hours. We are recording the session. The trainers are going to control the slides today. If you would like to, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, you are welcome to send in questions and comments using that Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, we will ask some of those questions out loud. If you are joining on the phone line, we do ask that you leave your phone on mute until those question and answer breaks. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you are interested in a certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit this feedback, the system is going to generate that certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website, which is itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. I do encourage you to visit the website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents available. Our online and classroom schedule is available for 2018, so you can learn more about upcoming classes as well. On slide 5, I'll introduce our trainers. All of our trainers are members of the ITRC team. Our first trainer today is Harold Templin of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. We also have Chris Stubbs with Ramble, Lizanne Simmons with Kleinfelder, and Randall Wrighty from Neptune & Company. And at the bottom of the slide, you see a link. So if you are interested in reading more about our trainers, we do have that information available. For now, I will turn the presentation over to Harold Templin at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Harold?
Okay. Thank you, Juliana. And as we get the training started today, allow me to set the stage for using statistics with your groundwater data. Let me ask you a couple of questions. In my work at the state of Indiana, it used to be that I would have mounds of data sitting on my desk, and people would come by and wondering, how do you know where, what data to use, where to use, what to start with, and these sort of things. And so I could see there was a lot of confusion with using statistics with your groundwater data. The use of statistics to evaluate groundwater data demands an adequate evidence of the data quality, a sufficient amount of data, and the proper data management. So let me ask you, are you drowning in your groundwater data? What data should you be using? Do you know what data to be used? Where do you start? Do you start with a QAQC? Do you start with the laboratory's first page? Or their last page? What is the data trying to tell you? You have these mounds of data, which represents a lot of resources, and do you know what it's telling you about the site, what it's telling you about the conditions of the groundwater? And do you know what is the best method or the best way to process to go about using the data that you have? So let me ask, can a statistical approach help manage your groundwater data? And I would say yes, and this training is going to reinforce that. If you're not a statistician, which the poll was showing that it was about that there were several that weren't, what we hope that you'll gain from this training is that you'll become a more informed consumer of statistics, that you'll have confidence, you'll build up a confidence to spot misapplications and mistakes. It'll help you in reviewing the selection of, well, which statistical test should I use for this question that I have, and just an overall understanding of the language of statistics. Then if you are a statistician, if you are the person that writes the statistical reports, we feel like this program, this training, is going to help you in making your conclusions more understandable to the general audience. So what I say to all these questions is that the ITRC's solution to this is the Groundwater Statistics for Monitoring Compliance Statistical Tools for Project Lifecycle, or let's just call it the GSMC document, web-based document. And what this document will do, it's going to help you ask the right questions to apply statistics. It's going to direct you to the appropriate statistical method, and it's going to maximize the value of your data. So the Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance team is composed of several different groups of people. It was formed in 2011 to basically try and put together a web-based document that would be friendly for users that were just getting involved in statistics or having to review statistical reports. This team is formed up, as you see, with experts from the Department of Defense, EPA, Department of Energy as federal partners, the industrial partners, state or government entities, as well as consultants. So the existing regulations differ widely and may not recognize the advantages and limitations of current statistical practices. And so that in the state that you're in, the regulations may not allow for statistics, or it may have this is what you'll do with statistics. But still, we want to point out that there are ways that you can use this web-based document to help get your point across. So what I have up here for just a simple example, a couple of simple examples, is the regulatory challenge of meeting a criterion. So let's just say, for example, we have these 8 data points, groundwater, after the active remediation has stopped, and we had this variation through the time period. That's pretty normal for after you've shut off an active remediation system. And we have the heavy red line is the established criterion of 0.5 milliliters, milligrams per liter. Well, let's say if I have 2 consecutive values below the cleanup level, then I'm okay. Well, as you can see, that we do have that in this case with the June and September measurements, but how certain are you that that's the correct way that we're really on an average below that value? What we should do instead is do a statistical approach. Let's look at an upper confidence limit around the mean, and by doing this test, which we'll talk more later about how to do that, we see that what we have is a value of 0.689 milligrams per liter, which is above the standard. So we would want to point that out, that you know we may have these 2 levels below, but if we do a statistical test on the average or the mean, we're showing it above the criterion. So that may be a way to present a case for this site cleanup. And the next example that we have is managing non-detects and censored data. So what we have here is a long list of values, and through this period of time, the facility has used many different detection values for their dissolved chrome. And we have, in some cases, 0.01, 0.001, and different ones. And then one time they had a matrix interference and had non-detection limit reported at like at 0.09. So we have these all these different values for the non-detect. So how should we decide how to evaluate the upper confidence of limit of this data package? Well, what we have pointed out in our web-based document, a method called the Kaplan-Meier method, which takes into account the different non-detect values of different levels and how close they are to the reporting limits that ground it, and comes up and gives you an upper confidence limit. And so we see if we just use a simple upper confidence limit, we have 0.0125 milligrams per liter versus upper confidence limit of 0.005 milligrams per liter. And once again, we have a difference there with our criterion that we had at 0.01 milligrams per liter. So with today's training class, we feel like that if you are reviewing or using statistical calculations in a report, or you're making recommendations or decisions based upon statistics, or you're demonstrating compliance for groundwater projects, then this document is for you, and this training was going to help you. By building upon your technical background and environmental experience and site compliance and cleanup, you'll be able to use this web-based document even if you don't have a specific expertise in statistics or have access to an in-house statistician. And during this training, we're going to show you how. So first, let me just give you a quick view of the roadmap before we're going with this training. First, we're going to look at how to use the document. Then we'll switch into getting ready to apply statistics to your data, have a question and answer period, then get back with applying the study questions that we have in different areas of background, compliance, trend analysis, and monitoring optimization. Then lastly, I'll come back and we'll have a summary and a question and answer break at the end. So the Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Document Framework, or the GSMC document, web-based document, is based around these five different project life cycles. Groundwater statistical methods have application throughout the life cycles of an environmental project, and it can be used in different parts of that cycle. The groundwater statistical test can support decisions made through any one of these cycles or however you have your project defined. Next, what we've done is we've brought up these specific study questions that you would have during the different projects, during the different cycles of your environmental project. So like if you were to click on, is there seasonality? Is that your question? What you can do with a web-based document then is it'll take you to that question. It'll point to you how you would make decisions to answer that question, what statistical methods you might use, and when you might be needing to have that question answered. Then lastly, we had the statistical approach, so that basically the study questions become a bridge between the life cycle and the statistical approach that you have, whether it's exploring the data, looking at different methods, or the actually selecting software tools to answer your questions. This document is not a tutorial on statistical tests and methods. But it does illustrate how these tests and methods, along with a general statistical approach, can address practical applications, challenges, and misapplications associated with groundwater statistics. In addition, the GSMC document lists available tools to conduct these tests and methods. With this understanding of the framework, then we see on this would be as you would go into the web-based document. This is on the title page. And what you can do is pick out the project lifecycle. If that's what you're wanting to start out with, you pick out that, well, we're doing monitoring at this point. And so you pick out that. It would lead you to which questions you might have with what statistical methods that you might use. And the software tools that you might use to answer the questions. All this would be used to give you a better decision for that project. Also with this, we want to point out, as it's not a tutorial, but a how-to, what we have done with our web-based document is basically tied it with the EPA's unified guidance so that if the web-based document talks about a specific statistical method, it'll link you to the unified guidance on how to use that method or how to calculate that method. As well, our GSMC document has a section on data quality objectives and helping you select the planning tools based upon the scientific method that identifies and defines the type, quality, and quantity of data needed so that as you remember back that pile of data on my desk that you can use the DQO process to pick out, oh, well, this is the data that I really need to look at. Then lastly, the web-based document also has many links to other statistical references, to ASTM methods, to other statistical textbooks, and online guidance that would be there. So with this, I think we're ready to turn it over to Chris Stubbs of Rambo and get ready to apply your statistics to your groundwater data.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Harold. So in this next section, we're going to just go over some of the basic principles that'll come in handy when applying a statistical method to groundwater data. First off, just to talk a little bit about what statistics is. And one way of thinking about it is it's the science of drawing conclusions from data. And there's a variety of different tools that you can use to help draw these conclusions. And start off with, we often just want to visualize the data by plotting it and looking at various ways of understanding the data without using any sophisticated statistical methods. And, you know, we have many tools that are kind of designed to separate the signal from the noise. And in the case of groundwater data, usually the signal is, changes in concentrations that are associated with site impacts to groundwater. And the noise is just variability in those concentrations that's just caused by, a more natural causes. So we also use these statistical tools to summarize large-scale behavior and quantify uncertainty. And ultimately, we're trying to use it to make better and more defensible decisions. So that's what we're going to look at in this section is just kind of the major elements of a statistical approach and how it would be applied to groundwater. All right, so to start off with, we're going to just go through a little crime story, nothing too serious. And it's just a burglary of a laptop was stolen from an office. And the police were very successful in finding the potential perpetrator. And they brought this Mr. Ivan Shifty in. Before the judge, for him to plead guilty or not guilty, and he decided to plead not guilty. And, you know, it's interesting to think about our court system, our justice system, as kind of an example of, you know, how to evaluate evidence. And in this case, we're trying to determine whether there's enough evidence to prove a defendant guilty. Because we go in, you know, everyone, there's this presumption of innocence. So we go in with the assumption that the defendant is not guilty. And this is, can be thought of as like a null hypothesis in a statistical approach. And then the prosecution must present evidence. It could be fingerprints, stolen goods. In this case, they found the laptop in the trunk of Mr. Shifty's car with his fingerprints on it. So there's some good evidence that would be presented to the jury to try to convince them to, you know, overcome this default assumption that the defendant is not guilty. And, you know, it's interesting to think about why, you know, why do we want to do this? You know, we're trying to prove someone's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, but why do we do it? And, of course, it's to prevent errors. And there's two types of errors we could make. You know, the first one is, you know, if someone's actually innocent and we send them to jail, you know, that's probably more serious error. We really want to avoid that one, and that's kind of why we go in with this presumption of innocence. And that type of error could be called a false positive error in a statistical approach. And the other error is if Shifty is actually guilty, but he goes free. And that's an error we want to avoid, but perhaps it's less serious than the first error. And we might call that error a false negative error. So this is a good illustration of some of these statistical principles. If we sort of shift over to thinking about the same kind of ideas, for a groundwater site example, one where perhaps we're at the site characterization phase of the life cycle. So we're just going in, we don't really have any data. But we're going to usually go in thinking that the site has not contaminated groundwater because we have no reason to think it has. So our null hypothesis, similar to the example, is that the site's not contaminated. And we can think about what are the various, we try and make a decision, limited data we have, and you know, we can kind of come up with various possibilities, which is if the site's not contaminated, really isn't not contaminated, here's the true state here in this column, and we say it's not contaminated, then that's great, that's a correct conclusion. But if we get it wrong and we say it's contaminated when it isn't, this would be like a false positive error. We try and avoid those, and of course we set a probability of avoiding false positive errors, and that's usually called the significance level. And we often give it that probability symbol letter alpha. Now, if the site really is contaminated, then of course there's two possibilities. We either get it right or we get it wrong. If we get it wrong, it's called a false negative error, and we often symbolize the probability of that happening with beta. And we often think about, instead of the possibility of getting it wrong, we usually think about it as the possibility of actually detecting whether a site has contamination or not, and that's usually referred to as the power. So we want to have a lot of power in our statistical analyses to find these contaminated sites. And the probability that we make this correct conclusion is just 1 minus the probability that we got it wrong, or 1 minus beta. All right, so moving along here, we look at this sort of general approach to statistical decision making. And basically the point of it is to try and avoid these errors. And as I said, there's two types of errors, the false negative error, the false positive error. And depending on the situation we're in, one of them is usually more important. So if we're, back to the court case example, then of course the false positive error is the one we really want to avoid because we don't want to send an innocent person to jail. But we might be in the situation where we're just looking at a site for the first time in a site characterization phase, and we really don't want to miss further investigation of a contaminated site. So that would be a false negative error that's more important for us to avoid. it's important to think about which type of error is the most important for your situation. Now, you've all heard this term statistical significance, and that's really only related to one of these error types. It's related to a false positive error. And it's basically if there's a statistical significant result, that means that there's a small chance that the result is a false positive. We can sort of decide what we mean by small, and we usually set our significance level usually to, you know, something like 5%, which is typical in other fields, other like medicine, for example. But it's important to recognize that we can choose a smaller significance level because we can sort of decide that we really want to be more certain that we're avoiding a false positive. So, for example, in the field of physics, where you're looking for new elementary particles, they might actually want a significance level of 1 in 3.5 million. So much stricter, much more effective at avoiding false positive errors. Anyway, so you can't just think about the false positive. You also have to think about false negative errors. Those are a little bit harder to quantify in that they depend on the variability of the data that we actually have. So we can't really exactly figure out what the false negative error rate is until after we've collected our data and looked at it and decided on, how many samples we have and the effect size, which is just how big of a difference in concentrations, for example, we want to be able to figure out. We always want to make sure we check the power of our evaluation, you know, particularly if we find we can't reject that null hypothesis. Because a big danger is if we don't have enough samples, you know, our analysis can be underpowered, meaning we just don't have enough samples in order to be able to detect an effect of interest, like a contaminated site, for example. All right, so in this next section, we're just going to go through some of the key aspects of a statistical approach. So first of all, it's developing a conceptual site model, very important, and something that we're all probably all familiar with. And the next step we might do is conduct exploratory data analysis, which would usually be plotting our data in various ways and just trying to understand, you know, understand the data, find out if there's any problems with our data quality issues that we need to investigate further, and just get a general sense of what potential conclusions we might draw from that data. Then we would design our statistical approach, our statistical sampling plan. This might involve actually collecting samples, or it just might be planning what we're going to do with the existing samples that we have and what kind of statistical tests or approaches we're going to use. Then we use those statistical approaches to evaluate the statistical evidence, make some conclusions, and then evaluate the uncertainty in those conclusions to make sure that those levels of uncertainty have been reduced enough. So and that's looking at those error rates, false positive and false negative errors. And then finally, we want to make sure we've satisfied all the assumptions of our statistical methods. All right, so we'll kind of go through these one by one. We'll start with the conceptual site model, or CSM, some sort of a written or graphical expression of, you know, what's going on with the site. So here's an example where we have a landfill, and kind of showing the major features of the site on this graphic, where we have a groundwater flowing. My pointer here, flowing beneath a landfill and discharging to a river, and in those, you know, we have various groundwater monitoring wells, which are these little circles with X's in them. And in those, we're just measuring specific conductance, which is a way of measuring, easily measuring the amount of dissolved solids that are in a groundwater sample. So we're measuring those at various wells, and then we also have a measure of that specific conductance in a river that's down gradient from the landfill, and this is a tidally influenced river. So that's our conceptual site model, and of course our question is, you know, is the landfill impacting groundwater? So we can think about answering this with a statistical approach. Here in this example, we're just going to look at specific conductance, but in a real site, of course, you look at other parameters as well. All right, so there's two general approaches we can take. There's inter-well testing and intra-well testing. So inter-well testing, we're going to compare multiple wells against each other. So we're going to put the wells into two different groups. One is the background wells, which is the upgradient of the site, and then the potentially affected wells, or compliance wells, which would be downgradient hydraulically from the site. And we compare those two groups and see if the downgradient ones are higher concentration than the upgradient ones. And if that's true, then the site might have impacted groundwater. There's another approach that we could use, which is intra-well testing, which is where we look at just one well at a time. And we look at the data from that well, and we have to have a time series of data from the well, and we divide that time series into two periods. One period is, data from, for example, before the landfill was there. So it can't be affected by the landfill because it was collected before the landfill was there. And then the second group is after the landfill was there. So we just compare those two groups of data from one single well. And depending on our conceptual site model, one of these might be a better approach. So in this case, let's just go back to our graphic here. In this case, we have this tidally influenced river, which appears to be giving us very high values of specific conductance in the surface water, and then also near the river. So in this case, I think an inter-well approach wouldn't be that great because you might be confusing the tidal influence with the impacts from the groundwater. So an intra-well testing approach would probably be the most appropriate based on this conceptual site model. All right, now after we've thought about our conceptual site model, we do a exploratory data analysis. And basically, I think this just means plot the data. Just always plot your data in as many ways that makes sense. And here I've listed sort of top five probably plots that you'd want to consider using. The time series plot, probably most people are familiar with. Look at trends or maybe inconsistencies. Box plots are good for comparing groups. Scatter plots are good for looking at the association between two different variables. Histograms and probability plots are good for looking at the distribution, the statistical distribution of our data. And we'll look at some examples of those as we go forward. So first is this time series plot. Pretty straightforward. Everyone's seen these. Here we're looking at the concentration of benzene in a well over time. And it's often used to look for trends or maybe outliers. So one thing to remember, though, is on these kind of plots, it's a great idea to always show non-detects, distinguish the non-detects from the detects. And so we can see what the detection limits are. Also, so there's some cases like this one, you see it's really the detection limits that are going down over time and not necessarily the data itself. So that's a good reminder just to indicate when you have non-detects on these plots, because that can be important sometimes. So box plots are great for comparing groups. So here's an example where we've got two groups, the compliance group of wells and then the background wells, which would be the upgradient wells. Box plots kind of have these different features that have different meanings. So this sort of line here in the middle is the median of the data. And then on the edges of the box itself are the 75th and 25th percentiles. Then we have these whiskers that come out, which sort of are meant to sort of encompass the bulk of the data. And then things that are sort of way far away from the bulk of the data, which would be potential outliers. And they're just shown as individual data points. And box plots can be done in different ways depending on the software you use, but it's kind of a typical look. So it's kind of nice because you can compare the central tendencies. So here we see the central tendencies measured by the median are pretty much the same between the two groups. There's a bit more variability in the compliance wells as a wider spread. And then there's some outliers that maybe we should look at in more detail to make sure that there's no data quality issues with them. So that's a nice approach to use when you're comparing groups of data. The next one to look at is the scatter plot, where you have two different variables. Like, for example, here we're showing a well where you've measured both arsenic and mercury. And we're wondering whether there's a relationship between those two wells, if they follow a sort of a linear correlation or what. And a nice way of showing that is just to plot them as a scatter plot, where we plot one variable against the other, as we have here. And you see that in this case, they kind of have a nice linear relationship, so they sort of all the data points in the scatter plot fall on a line, indicating a nice linear correlation for this example. All right, next is this thinking about our statistical sampling plan, and we want to always kind of do some planning, of course, and there's kind of sort of planning that you do before sampling, actually collecting groundwater samples, and then some that you might do after. So the prior to sampling, of course, you want to think about, you know, how many samples you need to control those decision errors, the false positive and false negative errors. So we want to kind of design our plan to pick the acceptable error rates, think about how many samples we're going to need in order to get those rates, and then actually conduct the sampling with the right number of samples. But then after we get the samples, we might want to take a look at the statistical power that we've actually achieved, which, you know, we need the data in order to fully do that, because we have to look at the variability in the data as well. So you can sort of think about this as a bit of a design problem with trade-offs between these different factors. So of course, we have the sample size is the one we you know, most often think about. We need to have an adequate sample size, but that's in, you know, it's the adequacy of our sample size depends on what kind of power we want, what kind of, you know, probability we're going to have of avoiding a false negative error, and our significance level, you know, how much we want to avoid a false positive error. So, and all those are also tied to the effect size, which is usually in the case of groundwater, you know, how big of a change in concentration is important to us, you know, as a practical matter, not statistically, because statistics could detect a tiny little change in concentrations, but that might not be at all important, you know, practically speaking. So we kind of want to think about all those things and how they trade off with each other. There's a lot of good guidance on this in our online guidance in Section 3, as shown here, and also there's the EPA guidance on data quality objectives. It has some other some good information about how to do this. All right, so finally, we've done our planning, and now we want to evaluate the statistical evidence. So the first approach you can take is that we'll talk about is called hypothesis testing, and this is the approach that's sort of similar to that court case, where we go in with a presumption, which is called the null hypothesis. So in the court example, it's, you know, going in thinking the defendant's not guilty. And then we compare, you know, sort of determine whether there's enough evidence to disprove that, or, you know, make us give up the null hypothesis in favor of an alternative hypothesis, which is usually just the converse of our null hypothesis. So, you know, you have to select this null hypothesis, and it's a little bit peculiar in that when you're thinking about the null hypothesis, you often just sort of choose a question that's kind of the opposite of what you're really interested in. So for example, if you're looking at, you know, of a site and you're trying to figure out if the concentrations of the site exceed background concentrations, you know, the null hypothesis would be something sort of like the opposite of that. You kind of come in with the presumption that the site concentrations are consistent with background. So that's the null hypothesis. And if we're looking at whether cleanup goals at a site have been achieved after some remediation, you know, our null hypothesis would be that the concentrations measured at the site are above the cleanup goals. And we need to see if there's enough evidence to make us change our mind about that. And then finally, if we're looking at whether there's a trend in concentrations, the null hypothesis might be that there's no trend in the concentrations, that the slope of the trend line is zero, essentially no trend. All right, so a few more details about hypothesis testing. So after you've defined your hypotheses, you pick the null hypothesis, and these alternative hypothesis, always just the converse of that. Then we take the data and we, you know, use our statistical software to calculate a test statistic. So we have to pick a statistical test that's going to be appropriate. So, for example, one of the more common ones is the t-test. So we were kind of looking at the difference between means of two different groups. So we get our software to calculate the t-statistic. And this is calculated under the assumption that the data that we've actually observed are following the null hypothesis. And the other thing that we get out of the software, perhaps more useful than the test statistic itself, is the p-value, which is the probability that that data that we observed, you know, could have occurred if the null hypothesis were true. And we often just focus in on this probability, this p-value, to see whether that p-value is small enough. That's just like so unlikely that the null hypothesis is true, given our data, that we want to reject that hypothesis. And that significance level that we pick is sort of how, you know, how low we want that p-value to go before we really are ready to reject the null hypothesis. So 5% is a very common significance level. So if we get like a p-value of 2%, then we're like, okay, let's reject the null hypothesis. But if we can't reject it, if our p-value is bigger than our significance level, then we sort of want to look at the power of our test, make sure we had enough data. Anyway, so just a little bit more on this p-value. Just a reminder, the p-values are helping us measure the discrepancy between the data we actually observe and what you'd expect if the null hypothesis is true. So you kind of think about the p-value as a measure of the strength of the evidence against our null hypothesis, where lower values, lower p-values, are stronger evidence because it's less likely that that null hypothesis could be true given our data. All right, so we can also take a different approach from hypothesis testing. And that's often, we often want to describe our uncertainty in when we're looking at, for example, mean concentrations, and we want to compare them to a particular standard. So if we have a bunch of data site, we calculate the mean concentration, and we say it's 5.1 milligrams per liter. You know, and the, let's say the standard we're trying to meet is 5, and we might wonder, well, there's a little bit of fuzziness in that mean because we're got a bunch of different data with variability. And how can we assess that the reliability of our estimate of the mean? And the typical way of doing this is with statistical intervals. And we've all kind of seen this statistical intervals shown as error bars on various measures of things like means. And they give us a sense of the reliability. There's different types of statistical intervals. The most common one is the confidence intervals. That's what probably everyone's seen. But there's other ones, such as prediction intervals and tolerance intervals, that are also can be useful for us when analyzing groundwater data. But they all have this feature of having an associated confidence level with the interval, you know, which is the probability that the interval is going to include our value of interest. So if we have a 95% confidence interval, you know, then 95% of the time we expect the mean to be, you know, the true mean to be within that interval. You know, as you'll see, we can actually use these intervals to conduct hypothesis tests. We'll take a look at that in a bit here. But first we're going to look at the difference between confidence intervals and prediction intervals. Because prediction intervals actually come up a fair bit in groundwater analysis, particularly when looking at RCRA sites where we have landfills where we're having to evaluate data. Prediction intervals are very commonly used. And they're different than confidence intervals. Confidence intervals are intervals on statistics that we've actually calculated from the data, such as means or medians or slopes. So they're summary statistics. But prediction intervals are telling us what would we expect to see if we took another sample. So from the same site, but if we took a new sample, you know, what would be the range of values that we might expect to see in that new sample? So here's an example where we're looking at total organic carbon. We've got a bunch of samples that we've collected already, which are actually shown here with these little diamonds. So here's all the data points. And we can calculate the mean, which is here, this little dot, and then the confidence interval around the mean. You know, it's not very wide. But if we think about it, what if we took another taurogranic carbon sample? You know, it's going to be much wider, and that would be what would be measured by the prediction interval. This could be, you know, pretty much anything we saw previously, plus a little bit extra, because there's still some uncertainty. So that's kind of illustrating the difference between the confidence interval, which is around the mean, and the prediction interval, which is around what a future sample might be. Another thing I'll just mention is we can, you know, this is showing two-sided intervals. We have an upper interval and a lower interval. But we can also use one-sided intervals where we only have an upper, for example, or we only have a lower limit. And we'll see some examples of that coming up here. So if we look at this connection between hypothesis testing and these intervals. So first we'll just think about in our first example, if we're looking at a site that's in the release detection or site characterization phase, in this phase we usually are kind of assuming that the site's clean. Going into our analysis, we have no reason to think it isn't, so we're going to assume for our null hypothesis that the site is not contaminated. And here we'll define that to be meaning that the mean of all the data are below the maximum contaminant level or MCL. For groundwater. So if we look at trying to construct some confidence intervals and verify this hypothesis or evaluate this null hypothesis, what we might do is construct the lower confidence limit on the mean. So this is sort of like the lowest possible value that we might expect the mean to actually be. And then we'll compare that to the MCL. And you know, if that lower confidence limit is actually below the MCL, then you know we're pretty confident that the site must actually be clean. But if we find that lower confidence level is greater than the mean, then you know we might reject the null hypothesis because there's not sufficient evidence to convince us that the site really is not contaminated. All right, now if we take the other type of site we might look at, where we have a site that we know is contaminated and we did some remediation at it, and now we're like, well, is the site, has the remediation done its job? Is it sufficiently clean? So here our null hypothesis is different. We're going to go in saying the mean concentrations measured at the site are greater than the MCL. And then to look at how we evaluate that hypothesis using confidence intervals, we construct our upper confidence limit on the mean. So this is would be the kind of highest possible value of the mean that we might expect. And we'd see if that upper confidence level is actually less than the MCL. And if it is, then we feel very confident that the site, that the remediation at the site, you know, was sufficient. And we could reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the site actually, you know, has been cleaned up. All right, so finally, we'll go through some of the assumptions that come up frequently when you're doing statistical analyses. The first one here is outliers, where here's kind of an outlier here. We're looking at a bunch of data from a well, and we have one sample where the benzene was non-detect, but the dextrolone was quite elevated. And depending on the method that you use, these kind of outliers can cause a problem with some statistical method. So you want to, you know, investigate them ahead of time to make sure that's actually really a correct value that you have. So you might check the lab report to make sure there was no, you know, transcription error or something like that. And then often there's, you know, if you have a really dramatic outlier like this, you might want to do the analysis once with the outlier, then again without the outlier to see if it's really going to make a big difference in your conclusions. Okay, so another, you know, very common assumption that we need to look at in using a statistical approach is to see whether the data that we're using follow a standard statistical distribution. And the ones that we normally think about are the normal distribution, bell curve type distribution, log normal is commonly used, and also gamma. which is similar to log normals, is a bit more flexible, kind of being used in more situations. And if we find our data follow these standard distributions, then we can use what are called parametric methods. Parametric methods are merely methods that rely on this assumption that the data follow a particular distribution. So if the data don't follow that distribution, then you shouldn't use those methods. You should instead use non-parametric methods, which don't have any assumption about distributions at all. So they're a bit more flexible, but the downside of them is you often need more data to reach conclusions at a similar level of confidence. This sort of needs more data to kind of make up for the fact that we don't have this assumption about what distribution the data follow. Well, how do you tell whether your data follow distribution? Well, a nice way of doing it is to construct a histogram of your data, such as this. It's kind of easy to see whether the data generally follow, a normal kind of symmetrical bell-shaped curve or not. Another way is to use a more specialized plot, which is called a probability plot, which kind of plot the data on a sort of special scale. And if the data all fall on a line, such as like this one does, then you conclude that the data are consistent with that distribution. So this is showing the data are consistent with a log normal distribution. Okay, so next we've got some of the other assumptions, which is first one's this independence assumption. So then we count up our samples for a statistical approach, and we kind of compare them to our plan for the number of samples we need. We have to only count independent samples. And so if we had a particular well, we went out and took a sample, and then the next day we went back and took another sample, those wouldn't really be independent samples because they're basically just sampling the same groundwater, and they're going to be highly correlated with each other because they're very, very close in time. So they're not going to be temporally independent, and it wouldn't be fair to count those as separate independent samples. And similarly, if we have like duplicate samples, of course, that's the same kind of thing. Or if we take samples from wells that are very close to each other in space, those wouldn't be independent samples either. So, one thing to remember is we don't want to sample too often at wells. The sort of standard approach is to sample quarterly, but we have to make sure we think about how quickly the groundwater is moving at a site to think about what independence would really mean. Another assumption that we need to think about sometimes is that if we're looking at comparing some samples to background, that when we look at the background, it's actually, background's not, doesn't have a trend in it. It's kind of just a, random variation, but no trend. So here we have a case where we kind of plot our data over time for toluene, and we see, it looks like an upward trend. So this might be a problem for certain comparisons to background. And we'd have to address this somehow, either looking at a subset of the data or maybe removing the trend before we do the analysis. All right, so that's basically all the assumptions. And we're just going to review what we've talked about here with some closing thoughts. And the first recommendation is just always plot our data. Take a look at what those plots say. Those are usually the most useful thing you can do. To think about whether we have sufficient data, or the right kind of data, to make good decisions with appropriate error rates. We want to think about both the false positive and the false negative errors. Maybe one of them is more important, but we should think about both of them and make sure we have enough data. If we don't have enough data, then we might need to collect additional data. You always want to confirm the regulatory requirements because they're quite different depending on which program you're in, which state. And you really need to know what those are to make sure you're kind of following the right rules. We have good general guidance in the online guidance, but you have to make sure that whatever you present is consistent with the regulations. You always want to combine your statistical analysis with other lines of evidence. If you have a statistical conclusion that doesn't make any sense in terms of the principles of hydrogeology, then that you have to look at that a little harder. You kind of make sure everything is consistent, with sort of basic principles, physics and hydrogeology and things like that. Can't just look at the statistics in a vacuum. Another way of saying that is this quote here, which is, If you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything. So that's just a reminder to not get carried away with, relying on a single statistical evaluation to make some very large conclusions. You want to look at all the data and lines of evidence together. Anyway, so with that, we're ready for our first question and answer break.
Thanks, Chris. Everyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to send in questions. If you're in the phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute now and jump in with a question. It's #6 to unmute. I'll also remind you at this point about our feedback form. At the end of the class, we'll include a link to the feedback form. If you wrap up before we go in the related URLs on the middle right, we do have the feedback form listed there. You select feedback form, look down a bit, select browse to. We do use your feedback and really look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form at the end of today's training class. If you'd like a certificate of participation, the feedback form is going to allow you to generate that. So you complete the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and once you submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. We also have a poll question for you here during our first question and answer break, and that's on the bottom now. You are welcome to select the areas where you use statistics on your projects, and you can select all that apply. And you may need to scroll down to see all of the options available. And we do have this set again, so everyone on the call is seeing the answers as they come in. A question has come in, how do you remove the trend from the data to analyze the data?
Well, okay, that's a good question. I think we'll see some good examples of these techniques in the later part of the presentation. But generally speaking, we could just fit a trend line to the data, like it was shown on the example. So using like linear regression or something like that, and then just sort of subtract off that trend part of the data, so that you're left with just the detrended data that is just kind of random variation around a value that's not changing with time. So that would be one simple approach to doing that.
Thank you. As we're waiting for additional questions to come in, we have an upcoming class on March 29 on geospatial analysis for optimization and environmental sites. And some of our same trainers are going to be involved in that training. Can you tell us more about what that class is about and why people on today's call should register for it?
Sure. The geospatial class is focusing on when you have a lot of data that you're using to construct a map. So you're not just looking at sort of individual data points, but you're trying to interpolate maps of plumes or water levels, things like that. And trying to optimize things like the sample spacing and analyze that data using a geospatial approach. We're going to talk about all those types of geospatial approaches and then how to use those to optimize some site decisions, such as I mentioned, optimizing sampling plans and perhaps a remediation scheme so that you minimize the amount of remediation resources you spend to take the best use the data to its fullest extent. So those are some of the things that we'll be talking about.
What are the most common mistakes made in statistical sampling planning?
Well, I guess the most common approach is to actually not do any statistical planning. I think many people kind of think about, I need to go out to the site and take some samples, and maybe 8 or 9 will probably be enough. So that's what we'll do. So I think the most common mistake is to not even consider, what kind of statistical analysis might be needed down the road, and to think about what appropriate error rates are that might be important to minimize, and to actually think about how many samples would be needed to reach those error rates. So Number one is just not actually doing any planning.
Often we have to estimate for proposals the number of background samples needed. Are there any rules of thumb to consider when estimating at the scoping stage?
Yeah, there's actually, I think picking the sample numbers is mentioned in the online ITRC guidance, but there's a fair bit of additional, very specific guidance from EPA in the, there's the DQO, the data quality objectives process, but also the unified guidance, which is a guidance for the RCRA program, but has a very detailed description of how you pick the appropriate number of samples to do a background evaluation. And you have to make a few assumptions about the variability of the data at a site. So if you have no data at all, you kind of have to make some assumptions, but often you have a little bit of data to work with. It kind of goes through a whole process of helping you pick the appropriate number of samples, and several of the software tools, I believe, that you can browse through using the online guidance also have some very easy to use tools for picking sample sizes.
Thanks. And right now, if you want to access those links in the related URLs on the middle right, if you select additional links and then go down a bit, select browse to, that'll open those links in a new window. And we do include a link to both our online guidance document as well as the unified guidance that Chris just mentioned. Are there any good guidance documents for analyzing surface water data?
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty much all the guidance that we've talked about would be applicable to surface water data. But I know that there is a kind of classic guidance put out by the U.S. Geological Survey on statistical analysis for water resources or something like that, which is is mostly focusing on surface water and also groundwater, but has a bit more on surface water specifically. But pretty much all the statistical principles are perfectly applicable to surface water, and also I'll mention analysis of soil data too.
Thank you. Looking at our poll results, you are welcome to select all that apply. We're here, the areas where you use statistics on your projects. And our top three are background compliance and trend analysis, and that's followed by monitoring optimization. And all of these are topics that we're going to talk about in the second half of the training. And we do have another question, but I do think we answer that in the second half of the training, so I want to go ahead and continue on. So we'll wrap up this question and answer breaks. You're welcome to send in more questions throughout the second half of the training class, so feel free to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to send in questions throughout the rest of today's training. And we'll get to as many of those as we can at the second question and answer break at the end of today's class. For now, we'll continue on, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Liz Simmons at Kleinfelder.
Thanks, Juliana. So we're now going to present some different examples of the application of statistics to groundwater sites. So in the next few sections, we're going to go through some study question applications and use the project life cycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that Harold and Chris just presented. And these could apply to some typical questions that you may want to ask. Because of the time involved, we won't be able to cover all the questions in this training, but we'll give you a flavor of what's in the guidance document. If you want to get some further discussions of all the study questions, they're found in Appendix C of the guidance document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we'll use the project life cycle stages and study questions to illustrate the connections to some hypothetical sites. These questions were developed by the team to easily navigate through typical issues and questions that may come up during the various phases associated with groundwater monitoring, and also for ways to evaluate the data. In the table at the left, We show project lifecycle stages, this time as columns, and the study questions are listed on the right. The study questions generally apply to each of the lifecycle stages and are noted with X's in the table on the left. In the guidance document, this is the main tool we use to connect between lifecycle stages and study questions, and it's used to help the reader find information that's relative to their particular site. The first concept we're going to discuss is background. For background, study questions 1 and 2 are applicable, and for study question 1, what are the background concentrations, applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question 2, our concentrations above background applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So, what is background? Sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state, but what we're talking about here is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, a baseline must be established because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of a contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what may be considered a pristine standard. And the web-based guidance document addresses this in more detail. Background is usually tied to some sort of regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like an MCL, a risk-based criterion, or some other threshold. And back on slide 31, Chris discussed intro-well versus inter-well. And consider it as a time-only relationship versus a space-time relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times. So what you're looking at is essentially a before, if possible, a during and after contamination picture. Natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. For inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells. So generally, you're comparing what you're considering as upgrading or background wells with downgrading or compliance wells. So here you're evaluating samples over both time and space. So when we're evaluating background, what do we need to consider? First off, known sources. For example, how many sources are not related to site contamination? The distance and direction or the geologic, hydrogeologic information, for example, estimated groundwater gradient, fracture flow, evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data, etc. Also, you need to look at multiple aquifer characteristics. For example, do you have a perch zone? Are there multiple aquifers? Because if that's the case, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate. And you need to look at data quality objectives. And these should be developed up front before you really do anything else. I think Chris talked about this a little bit as well. You need to make sure that you've got sufficient samples to provide reliable results. And you also need to look at the quality of the data set. For example, you know, do you have multiple detection limits, things of that sort. Basically, what you need to do is to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of your assumptions. As Chris talked about in his previous segment, we should use exploratory data analysis methods to help evaluate potential background data sets. And this is discussed in detail in sections 3.3.3 and 3.5. An initial step would be to simply inspect the data to determine the frequency of detection, representativeness of samples, and whether there's one or more multiple detection limits, time span of data. For example, can some of the data be too old? And consistency of analytical methods. For example, if you're looking at BTECs, you could be looking at samples that were analyzed EPA methods 8020, 8021, 8260, or some of the actual drinking water methods. To get a quick visual, you can use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, or scatter plots to plot the data set to provide some sort of insight into the overall spread and potential distribution of the data that you have. And finally, determine the distribution of that data set to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where, it might not fit the normal distribution, or you may not have enough samples. And also, which statistical methods will be needed in your evaluation of background? For example, if you run a t-test, which is a parametric method, it is sensitive to outliers. Most regulatory governance, for example, RCRA, requires establishment of background. And this example shows how potential background well data can be evaluated to determine whether the data set can be used to characterize background. So this example here applies to study question one, what are the background concentrations? And also to study question two, are concentrations greater than background concentrations? For study question one, we'll use descriptive statistics, and we'll use inferential hypotheses for study question two. So this example site shows a hypothetical metal recycling site. As I said, this is hypothetical. It's not a real site. Where arsenic's the primary chemical of concern, and the groundwater plume's been characterized. For this site, the conceptual site model's been completed and validated. Hydrogeology has been studied, and based on hydrogeology, these are the upgradient wells, which are wells 1 and well 2. The side gradient wells, which are wells 8 and well 7. And the down gradient wells, which are wells 3, 6, 5, and 4. And this is based on the conceptual site model. The objective is to identify a data set that would be consistent with background. We first would select a potential data set and then evaluate the quality, the shape, and the distribution of that data set. What are our data quality objectives? How do they apply to the number of samples required? Are there any non-detects that must be addressed? And does the data have a stable mean and variance? Are there trends? Are there outliers? And what's the distribution? We need to look at all this stuff. And here we've selected the data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells, and that's wells 1 and 2, over a two-year period. And for our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. In this particular data set, notice that there aren't any non-detects, and both upgradient wells are also below the MCL. There's a number of methods and tools to do preliminary statistical analysis. And, for example, we can use probability plots or time series plots. For interpretation of the results, we need to understand the source of the variation, whether it's natural or man-made. We need to look at environmental settings or information from research or published studies. We need to look at temporal changes in the data. For example, rainy seasons versus dry seasons, and also look at the presence of outliers. Then, based on the analysis and interpretation, does your conceptual site model need to be revised? Just remember, conceptual site models are living documents. If there appears to be another upgradient source, update your conceptual site model. In this case, based on the graphical methods we used, well, W1 appears to be fairly consistent with what is expected for a background well, where well W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Upon further research, those two points both occur in April, and in April there's larger runoff from the mountains where there are higher arsenic concentrations in rocks. Therefore, both of these can be considered background. But more often, a specific reason for the outliers isn't known. And this is where statistical methods come in handy in being able to manage that outlier data. Next, we're going to discuss how statistics apply to monitoring compliance. For monitoring compliance, we move to study questions 3 and 4, For study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion? Applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. For study question 4, when will that criterion be met? Applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. Again, because of time constraints, study question 4 isn't addressed in this particular internet-based training, but we will go through study question 3. Why do we do monitoring and evaluate site characterization? Site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of temporal and spatial data. And we evaluate chemical concentrations for compliance with various monitoring, groundwater monitoring protection criteria. For monitoring design, we need to look at a few things. What are your potential contaminants and how have they changed over time? For example, if you've got chlorinated hydrocarbons, are you looking at PCE, TCE, vinyl chloride, or kind of a combination between all of those? It's done to identify a release. It is done to develop a conceptual site model or update the conceptual site model that you've already got, and also for compliance with regulatory requirements. Groundwater protection criterion, groundwater criteria compliance can be based on an MCL. It can be based on background concentrations, based on what's around the area. It can be based on a risk-based value, which is, an exposure scenario. Or it can be an eco-protection value. And compliance measures should be presented up front in a quality assurance project plan. For example, the number of samples that you're going to use. You should know the distribution, whether it's parametric, normal or log normal versus non-parametric, where it doesn't necessarily fit the distribution or there may not be enough samples. What is your regulatory threshold? And this varies depending on, what compliance criterion you're addressing. And also that compliance point. And that could be a number, a maximum limit, or a set value, or some sort of, negotiated value. For our monitoring compliance example, we're going to focus on study question 3. Are concentrations above or below a criterion? And once again, we're looking at our hypothetical metal recycling facility. And we've already determined that wells 1 and 2 are background wells. And based on our conceptual site model, wells 7 and 8 are side gradient and outside of the plume. So for this question, we're going to focus on wells W3, W4, which is the furthest away, W5, and W6, which are within the plume and or down gradient of the suspected source. All right, so here's our data set for wells W3 through W6. If you take a notice in it, our MCL here is 10 micrograms per liter. W3 is the closest well to the source, and it moves down to W4, which is down gradient of the source, farthest down gradient. And if you also look at the data set, it has the same number of samples and date ranges as we saw for wells W1 and W2, and it also meets our data quality objectives. There's no non-detects in this data set, and note that the data set presented above mimics an actual laboratory data set, where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on threshold detection limits. Based on a conceptual site model, as I said, W3 is closest to the source, and W4 is farther down gradient. W5 and 6 are intermediate wells, so let's keep that in mind as we move on here. All right, we're going to look at wells W3 and W6 first. And as we said, these are W3 is closest to the source. W6 is just right downgradient from that. And if you look at this, you'll notice that samples from W3 are about 6 to 9 times the MCL, and samples from W6 are about twice the MCL. But there's also less variation in the data from W6 than you see in well W3. And as we're moving down gradient again, we've got wells 5 and 4. And as we said, well 4 is the furthest away. And because of that, samples from W4 are all below the MCL. Concentrations are fairly consistent, while the samples from W5 straddle both sides of the MCL, which, as we said, is 10 micrograms per liter, and have a slightly larger spread. So if we're looking at this from just looking at this, for W3, W4, and W6, you may not need statistics. That may be true, but it's also a large misconception. And I believe both Chris and Harold talked about this previously. There's always uncertainty in those results, and the real usefulness here is in the sample results from W5, which is, you know, obviously the harder case. Chris previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his segment. And as we're evaluating the data from the 4 wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And these are discussed in detail in the guidance document. Now, there's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they basically bind a single population. The mean or the average is a typical confidence measure. And the mean here is shown in the horizontal color lines. Let me kind of do here. So, for example, the mean in the W3 sample set here is in green, and the mean for the W4 sample set is in blue. The mean is based on multiple observations so that a decision can be made with statistical confidence. And for example, one point doesn't prove the mean or max is below a certain criterion, and one point above it doesn't violate that criterion. Now, the black arrows, and as I see, you can see through here, this is W3, show the confidence interval on the mean for the different well sample sets. So for an example of variability, let's look again at the W3 sample set, which is in green. So the confidence interval here is greater than that for the W4 sample set, where the confidence interval is much smaller. Confidence intervals can also be based around things such as an upper percentile or a median. And percentiles can vary too, depending on your risk tolerance. But typical values are 90, 95, 99%. And the number of samples required to calculate the confidence interval for your site should be based on specific data quality objectives. And there should be a number that's sufficient to compensate for variability of the data, uncertainty, false negatives, and false positives. Now, this particular site happens to be in the state of Washington. And since it's in Washington, we must use the guidelines that's been designed by that state. So it should be noted that this is one method. It doesn't necessarily match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what the state has chosen. In the unified guidance, we talk about regulatory, or in the guidance document, sorry, not the unified guidance, we talk about regulatory barriers for various states. And Harold's also mentioned this previously. So after we go through the Washington state guidance, we're going to do an example of this project as a requisite that uses the unified guidance. And these two examples are given to illustrate how the results of statistical analyses are used, and that they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. So CLEAN will most likely be based on some sort of state-prescribed basis that may or not be statistical. In this example, the data from wells were evaluated using the state of Washington compliance test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% upper confidence limit, or UCL. So let's go through the state of Washington guidance. And the first criterion is the upper 95% of the confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard? And for wells W3, W6, and W5, that would be no. And for well W4, that would be yes. The second criterion is the maximum data point value less than 2 times the cleanup standard? And for well W6, that would be no. For wells W3 and 6, that would be no. For wells W5 and 4, that would be yes. And the third is, are 10% of the data above the cleanup standard? And so if we look at this for wells W3, 6, and 5, the answer is yes. And for well W4, the answer is no. So if we're looking at this from a state of Washington guidance, then wells 3, 6, and 5 are not in compliance, and well 4 is in compliance. So the main question here, and we won't necessarily address this, but it's something you need to consider, is if the concentrations remain above that groundwater protection criterion, then when will the site be in compliance? As referenced in our guidance document, when looking at a RCRA situation, and this is based on 40 CFR 264.99, the US EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. So let's look at the same site based on that guidance. As Chris described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration, and the appropriate statistical test is the null hypothesis with the mean less than the groundwater protection criterion. In this case, the groundwater protection criterion is the MCL, where the means assumed to represent the true mean concentration. We conclude that a well is in compliance when the lower confidence limit of the mean is less than the groundwater protection criteria. In other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within the confidence interval we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. In the table above, we've calculated the 95% confidence interval for the mean of the concentrations for each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. And again, to evaluate distribution, you may also use some distributional tests, which are described in Section 5 of the online guidance, to figure out whether your data follow, what kind of distribution your data follow. You need to look at the assumptions in your test. Now back to this, we compared the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter. When the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL, we concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, wells W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and wells W4 and 5 are in compliance based on the unified guidance. Now, in this assumption, we're looking at it from a release detection perspective, which is the null hypothesis is that the well is in compliance. If the groundwater protection criterion falls below the UCL, then the null hypothesis won't be rejected until the groundwater protection criterion is also below the lower confidence limit to be sure that background exceedances don't predetermine the relationship of those increases versus the groundwater protection criterion. Now, as I said, this is from a release detection perspective. For remediation or corrective action, the null hypothesis is actually reversed. So, again, this demonstrates the differences in regulatory framework. Now, I'm going to turn the time over to Randall Wrighty from Neptune & Company, who's going to talk a little bit about monitoring optimization and trend analyses. Randall?
Yeah, thanks, Liz. So if you happen to be following along in your own presentation, we're on slide 65 right now. And we're going to cover a couple more topical areas. First one's going to be on trend analysis, and then we're going to talk about monitoring optimization. So when we go back to the poll, we looked at the different responses. This is what we've seen pretty much every training is by far the trend analysis is the most commonly used set of statistical methods, and monitoring optimization is the least used. So so this is another good point to emphasize in this training is that if it's a topic that you're pretty familiar with and you want to just refresh your memory on some of the assumptions, the web-based guidance document, you can navigate in there and find a specific kind of test that you're of the web-based guidance document. So that's one of the nice things about the web-based guidance document is accessible in different places, get different parts of the content. Okay, well, so we have four of the 10 questions are related to trend analysis, and we'll cover three of these. So question eight is a spatial question, deals with changes over distance. And if you want to get some more information on that particular question, you can go to section 5.15 in the web-based guidance document. And I guess also make another plug for the ground geostatistics remediation optimization training class, because you can get a lot more information on spatial methods in that class as well. Okay, well, we've mentioned this several times already about plotting your data. So this is an example of a scatter plot. So we're showing an analyte concentration over time. We have about 3 years of data, and we have monthly measurements over that period of time. And this is just plotting all detected values. And certainly just plotting the data is somewhat informative. You can see what's happening, what the changes are. But it's a little bit hard to actually understand, you know, what the rate of change might be or the direction of change. So that's why you go ahead and do something like linear regression. So this just shows an example where we applied, have a line from simple linear regression on top of these data. And now you can see this is what the overall change is over this three-year period. You can also see it's a positive change, and it's somewhat substantial. It's about 10% increase from the beginning to the end on average. But we can also see there's some variation around that line. So that's another question that came up about, when you have a data set and you want to look at adjusting it. So this is one of the questions you might have. What are the reasons for doing this and what are the methods? Okay, well, what about some general applications for trend analysis? So trend analysis really can be used pretty much in any of the project lifecycle phases. In particular, Liz talked about background data, and so did Chris. So one question you might have is, are background levels stable? And what this means, really in statistical sense, are the samples that are collected represent background? Are they independent and identically distributed? So if they're not, if there's a trend over time in your background data set, then you can come to some incorrect conclusions. If it's a decreasing trend for whatever reason, then you might think that things are improving, where they're actually it's just the change in the background, and the same condition can occur if there's actually an increasing trend in background. So something to be aware of, and trend analysis can help you determine that. Well, other cases are, looking at release detection. You can see if concentrations are steadily increasing as opposed to just cyclical, going up and down. Assessing compliance, you can look and see whether or not monitored natural attenuation might be reasonable with some number of years. And we'll talk quite a bit about optimization, is the sampling effort appropriate? Basically, how many samples you need to collect to characterize a particular well. Well, here's another part of the web-based guidance document. We have this is an example, Appendix A.2. Appendix A has some examples presented in the guidance document. And this is showing a fairly strongly seasonal case. This is just another hypothetical case that we have for the document. And this is showing concentrations. And you can see that on the y-axis, that actually we have a log scale. So it's going over about two orders of magnitude, roughly, from the low to the high value. And again, we're just here showing the values are the circles, unadjusted values. And then we have an overall mean across all these data. And then we have what we're showing also a red line. The solid line is are the adjusted data. So the adjusted data are showing much less variability than the original data. Okay, so why is this? So if we look at the data in a little more detail, I've just highlighted here the samples that were collected in October. So we have samples collected over a dozen years, and they're collected every quarter. So there's a January, April, July, and October. So the October samples tend to be the highest. And actually, you can imagine one thing that you might do, we've gotten questions about this in the past, is, well, actually, you could just evaluate each season separately. But the benefit of, in particular, of having an ability to take out this overall seasonality trend is that you can include all the data, basically, in the regression then. So in particular, if you have a relatively short number of samples, like 3 years of data, if you were to try to do a regression on each quarter, you only have three quarters, so it'd be impractical to do. So that's one reason why with groundwater lots of times there's seasonality, and one approach is to basically remove the trend. So when you do that, there's a couple of steps in the process. Basically, the first thing is, that's why the overall mean is shown here. That's the overall mean of the data set, and it's on a log scale. And then you look at the different seasons, and so you'd have a mean for the October values. And then you're going to look at the relative difference of each of these points from that mean from October. So if you look at these October samples, the mean's going to be somewhere around in here. So then you're going to look at the difference between this value and the mean from October, and then you can add that into what you have from the overall mean. And that comes up with the adjusted values. And so the adjusted values are, like I said, they're a method for basically using more of your data for the overall trend. Okay, well now how about the trend analyses you might do? So in this case, again, we applied linear regression is one of the methods to look at this, and there's also the Thiel-Senn line, which is from a parametric method. And again, we're showing the circles. Now we're just saying here's the adjusted data, or the circles, as opposed to the original data. And you can see that if you look at the adjusted data, it's a little bit easier to see the overall trend is decreasing. And the other interesting thing about this particular example is that the nonparametric method and the linear regression, which assumes a normal distribution, both came up with the same result, basically. And the reason for that is that these data were log normally distributed, and so that's not too surprising. And we're not meaning to imply that you should just pick multiple methods and use which one you like, but just illustrating this particular case, these two methods came out with similar values. If you're doing this for a project, then if you can fit the data to a normal distribution, in this case a log normal, then you would use a linear regression as the method for this showing the trend. Okay, what about another example for trends? So this is a case where we have a data set, and this is a little bit shorter period of time. We have about 2.5 year period of sample, particular well. In this case, again, we have all detected values. In this case, we have TCE concentrations. And here we're showing, basically, if you're looking at this data set, it has a fairly significant trend. And so it isn't really correct just to take the data, like Liz was showing, and you calculate a confidence limit of the data on the data without considering the trend. But we have a method here that's based on their non-parametric method, Thiel-Senn line again. And we're just showing, at what point in time did the sample first. So we can see here within this period of time, the first sample is marked here that goes below the cleanup goal. Okay, then what about when the confidence bound? Now that's another point, another sample further, where the confidence bound on this sample, on the trend, is below the line. So this is also somewhat obvious from this example, but it's useful to look at, and especially in contrast to our next example. So this case is where we're just interpolating within what we've measured. So we have a period of time, about 2.5 years again, and we're looking within this period of time and saying, did we attain a clinic goal within this period and with a 90% confidence given the trend. So that's the point of this example. And a little bit more interesting example is we talked about natural attenuation and projecting forward. So again, this is our example data set that's in Appendix A. So it's, again, on a log scale. And here we have the data set, and this is the 12-year period here over that period. And we have, from that period, we have a model that we have fit to the data. So the model is going to be basically primarily the slope. You know, what's the rate of change in this concentration over time? And if we just look at the model itself, it's just this straight line right here. It goes through, and then at that, again, so there's the middle of the data. We're going in the future. So we have the line here is the best estimate. Okay, so that's the next. So then that's the range. So basically, this is the best estimate here in the rate of change. And then these two other points are basically the confidence bounds in that rate of change. And if you look at this model, what you'll notice is that when we're extrapolating from what we know to the future, that the confidence bounds are increasing. And so if you think about the model, well, the slope could be a little bit shallower, which means it's going to take longer to reach the criterion, or the slope could be a little bit steeper. And this is what we've seen in other cases. We look at like things like very complex models, you know, hurricane projections. You know, over time, there's more uncertainty in where the path's going to be. In this case, it's a fairly simple model. If we just think about this slope being kind of anchored here at the center of the data, and it's going to go up and down from there and lead to these ranges of projections of when you might meet it, which is quite a wide range. And so you might have, there might be concerns about, you know, natural attenuation in this case. It's based on the wide range and the amount of time they're reaching this criterion. Okay, well, let's go to the last topical area, so monitoring optimization. And we have two questions identified for monitoring optimization, and one question has to do with the adequacy of sample frequency. So if we're at a particular well, how many samples are collected over time? And then the other one has to do with spatial coverage. Do we have an adequate number of wells for whatever things we're trying to estimate about the plume? Okay, so I'll make another note here about the geostatistics remediation optimization. So if you're interested in these kind of tools, we do cover them in some detail in the geostatistics for remediation optimization, and so that's a training class that's coming up. The other thing, as Chris was talking about, when you're looking at groundwater data, so there's the statistical tools, but you always have a conceptual site model. And so when you're thinking about, you know, wells and even spatially, if the wells are, you know, basically tapping into different aquifers, then they give different kinds of information. So that's one part of it. Another part of it might be, well, what is the rate of groundwater flow? So really how fast is that groundwater moving and what are you trying to capture? So those are important things that aren't necessarily directly included in the statistical optimization tools. But the idea is that you're going to have optimization means that there's more efficient data collection. One can argue that, well, it's always better to have more data. So if you collect samples every day or more than one a day, well, you have more information. But there's basically diminishing returns as you collect more and more samples because the samples are basically becoming redundant. They're giving you the same information, and you're paying for that, and at least the responsible party is, and then everybody has more information to look at than they really need. And so there is a point for, you know, having a more appropriate amount of data. So basically you'd want to have a sampling design that was optimized by reducing the correlation redundancy in the results and having the adequate data for accurate decisions. So this implies also that you have to have established the DQOs for your project. You know, what are the objectives? You know, what questions are you trying to answer with your groundwater data? Okay, well, let's talk about temporal optimization. It's a little more straightforward. So the idea, again, is mentioned, well, consecutive sampling events redundant. If they're on the same day, they're probably pretty redundant. Statistically, this is there autocorrelation? Is there correlation amongst the measurements over time? Is one value pretty much the same as the next? So the idea is that you're going to want to adjust the sampling frequency, you know, to minimize the correlation, but still capture whatever trends exist. And the other way of thinking about this is through phase sampling, so you can actually have a little bit more intense sampling over time, and then see, you know, what actually is adequate. You know, the monthly and quarterly sampling is are just kind of based on convention. There is some conceptual model basis for not sampling, you know, too frequently. So that's why quarterly is kind of the default in many cases. Well, one of the approaches, again, this is an example that we have in Appendix A, 8.4. So we have a couple of examples there, and this is called iterative thinning. And this is actually using a software package called Visual Sampling Plan. And there's a couple of aspects to this. So again, first, what the software tool lets you do is it plots the data. So if we plot the data, you know, the original values are these smaller circles that are all solid. And that's the original data. And then it's going to fit a smoothed function to the data. And that's what these red filled circles are here. It's fitting a smoothed data set to that overall trend. And then the other thing it's showing here are the confidence bounds. And so you can select different confidence bounds. So this is a 90% confidence interval on this smoothed data. So then what it's going to do, and you could do this conceptually yourself, you could take the data set and you can remove half the samples, and you can see what trend you get. And you can remove three-quarters of the samples, you know, et cetera. So you can do different amounts of thinning, removing of samples, and see what the resulting trend is. And so then the objective is to see, well, if I remove, you know, half the samples, am I still capturing this 90% confidence interval with some frequency? In essence, like a high confidence, like a 75%. And so that's basically how you set this up. So, and then the software gives you a solution depending on how many, whether you select the default or you select your own parameters. And the answer was 227 days. So basically you could sample, instead of quarterly, you could sample every other quarter over this period of time. So then the other thing to make a note of, again, when you're doing any statistical method, in this case, it's, you know, it's fitting a model to your data. And so, you know, there's some values that are above the smooth data set. But then in particular, there's a set of values down here, you know, those five values I'm circling down there that are low. So they're basically the lack of fit in the model. So the software is not really taking into account the lack of fit in the model. It's taking into account, you know, what we fit with, you know, 90% confidence. So it's allowing some values to be outside of there. So the question comes to, well, why are these values low? Is there a particular reason for them to be low? Are we concerned about, you know, missing these in the trend analysis? So you have to look at this when you're doing some of the methods. We actually have a second example in appendix I refer you to look at where it doesn't have this kind of odd behavior where we have some values that are lack of fit. And it's just sort of an interesting thing to think about, and when you're doing these kind of approaches, you have to be careful about, you know, some of the answers you get. And again, you have to take a look at the data and take a look at your conceptual site model. Well, another approach we have in the web-based guidance document is from the Meros software. And Meros is the Monitoring and Remediation Optimization System. And so this particular iteration of the software had this approach for cost-effective sampling, and it's based on two separate analyses. And one of them is linear regression. So linear regression, in this case, is giving us this rate of change. So it's basically here, in essence, along the columns in this table. And then the rows are based on the Mann-Kendall analysis, which is giving us the direction of the change. And so it's either increasing or decreasing. And then for the high and medium and low rate of change, it has to do with relative to a standard that you've put into the software. So the way this works is that you have data for a particular well, and you can put in this, look for the historical trends. And it's going to recommend, either quarterly, semi-annual, or annual sampling. And so you can see that the quarterly sampling, so the highest amount of sampling recommended, is when you generally have a high rate of change, and in particular more if it's a, increasing high rate of change. And so the high rate of change is based on the MCL or standard, and it's 2 times the MCL, and low is less than half. And that's the annual sampling is based on basically when you have a low rate of change. So this is another method, and I haven't used this one myself, but I've used the one from VSP. And so, again, you have to look at your data, look at the, in this case, be multiple analytes you'd have to look at relative to the cleanup go. You might get different results for different analytes. Potentially, you could have different suites for different quarters. But you have to look at what the practicality is when it comes to the solution. Okay, well, spatial optimization. Spatial optimization is inherently a little more complex than temporal optimization, but in some ways you could think of it conceptually the same way. Part of it's easy, so in terms of redundancy, it's the same question. You could actually, take the data set you have, the wells that are, for a network, and remove them. And say, well, do I get basically the same result in terms of, plume mass or rate of change or whatever the parameter is you're trying to measure? And it's a little more difficult to understand what the uncertainties are with, new wells where you might have more uncertainty in the plume. But conceptually, you can kind of do that, too, with some different mapping techniques. But luckily, there's some software tools available to help us do this. And so, and you can basically remove, it can go through and iteratively remove wells, sets of wells, and then it can help you identify these areas of higher uncertainty in whatever you're trying to measure. Well, there's a kind of a set of tools. So one is the spatial redundancy well removal. So this is, the plot is just showing you it's a basically interpolation method. So these triangles are giving you the weightings for these different locations. When you're looking in between these locations, it's interpolating. So it's just like the example we were talking about earlier with the time trend and looking at within a period. So we're interpolating within this network of wells, and these are the boundary wells around the side. So N0 and then has all these boundary wells. So one reason why I like to just show this particular example of interpolation is not you worry about specifics about the Voronoi diagrams or Delaney triangles, but it helps to emphasize edge effects. So if this was actually our network and we had all these wells, N1 through 5, there'd be a lot of edge. We have only one well where there's actually something that we can interpolate between the two. So that's kind of something you have to be aware of when you apply any of these spatial tools is, the edge effects, and sometimes there's boundary effects. And again, I guess the GROS class has some really interesting discussion methods for how to deal with that. But in terms of the methods for evaluating redundancy, we have one set of methods are what we can call based on genetic algorithms, and these are actually nothing to do with biology, but they're computer programming algorithms. And then the GTS software, which we'll talk about in a second, has its own version of this where it goes through and helps you. You go through your network, and it can work with a very large, complex network and identify redundancy that way. Then there's the slope factors and relative errors. Krieging has another method for coming up with uncertainty from a geostatistical method. And like I said, if it's a fairly small network, you could probably do some things more qualitatively and just remove things, remove them one at a time, and see what happens to your estimates of your parameters. Okay, well, just to kind of illustrate some aspects of one of the tools, so the one I mentioned just a second ago was the GTS, Geostatistical Temporal Spatial Software. And this is just a screenshot of one of the setups in the software and illustrates some of the things that it's going to look at. So first of all, it's got the pluses here are the existing wells, and there's existing wells over this, site view. We have a plan map showing where we have data. And then what it's going to do is it's going to estimate this coefficient of variation, which is a measure of the uncertainty in your well parameters. And you'll notice that there's more than one circle at some locations, so GTS actually has the capability of dealing with more than one parameter at a time. So what it's showing is that there's a couple different estimates of coefficient of variation for different parameters. When there's just one circle, it just means, well, they just overlap. They're both low. And you can think of the size of the circles as giving you a qualitative information on the amount of variability that you have in the interpolated data set. So just looking at this map then, it's giving you kind of a gut feel for, where you have fairly low uncertainty in this part, and there's some fairly large circles, at least for some analytes down here. And you can also see that there are some, again, we have an edge effect down here, there's some fairly, few wells in this area. So there's areas that, looking at this information qualitative, you might say, well, there's probably need for more wells there. Okay, well, just to wrap up, I mentioned already that there are software tools. So when we have, one of the things in the web-based guidance document is we have this Appendix D, and these are different sections of Appendix D highlighting some different tools that can help you with temporal and spatial optimization. And they're kind of sort of from the simpler to the more complex. And of these tools, the one that can do and by its name you would guess this, it can do both the spatial, geostatistical, and temporal spatial software. So it can handle basically optimizing the network. We're looking at both, numbers of samples per well and number of wells over space. VSP can do both, but you can only do the temporal, the time series with wells, and then you have to do the spatial separately. So I think with that, turn the presentation back over to Harold.
Okay, thank you, Randall. So as we summarize our training today, before we get into that, I wanted to talk about three different areas of our software, of our web-based document: the software tools that Randall was talking about, Section D, the data management in Section 6, and then the statistical methods. Under the statistical methods, Chris, Liz, and Randall all talked about specific methods and specific applications. And what the web-based document does, basically, is it groups the different methods according to their their application. So, like if you were to say, let's look at trends, it would take you to section 5.5, where it would list the application of the different trend methods and the study questions that they're linked to, the assumptions that you have to do that method, and the strengths and weaknesses. And then, as always, there's a reference and a link to the unified guidance where it will tell you more information about that method and specifically how to calculate that method. So then we would go on to the Appendix D, as Randall was talking about. We have the team had, when they first were getting organized, sent out a survey about the use of different software packages for evaluating groundwater data. And then they took that survey along with their own specific knowledge of using different software packages. And we basically came up with, at that time, as you realize, was about 3 years ago, these 23 different software packages that you could use to analyze your groundwater data. Now, there's other software tools out there, and also there are other software packages that may do a be able to manage software, your groundwater data, but it's mostly important to realize, you know, here's what I have an idea of what you want done before you actually try to purchase one of these software packages or use them, to make sure that they're following what you need to be done. With the web-based document, you can click on any one of these software packages, and it'll tell you, and it'll send you to a page about that software tool, giving you the approximate cost, the operating system requirements, the easy use, the how to import the data, the benefits and limitations, and references. And the references may be pretty important in these cases, since software packages seem to change quickly. And so you, after you've read what you thought you may want, you should probably check with the references to make sure that's the software package that you need. And also, once on this page, you also have what they call a capabilities table. And within this capabilities table, what we've done is taken the different test methods that we talk about throughout the web-based document, and we list whether this specific software package has any capabilities of doing that. So take, for example, the statistical methods on handling non-detects. So what we've talked about is simple substitution and Kaplan-Meier and ROS and the colon methods. And what this specific software tool can do is it has total capabilities of handling the simple substitution and somewhat or some capabilities in handling the colons method, but has really no capability of handling Kaplan-Meier. And so what you would do is, you know, you could go to this and say, well, I want these different methods. You could find the software package that best handles this, and then you can go back and get a reference on the different tools that, different things that this software tool can do. Then the third thing that I wanted to talk about was the big challenge of handling your groundwater data. Remember back, once again, that desk of mine full of groundwater data. Well, what you can do, want to do, is to establish a good database to handle your data. And in section 6 of the web-based document, we talk about this. You know, first of all, as we said earlier, based upon your data quality objectives, you may find out, this will tend to point you to the data that you want to manage. And then as it's occurred through time, the different laboratories are able to send you the data already formatted in the format that would fit to your database. And like EPA has their database, the stage electronic data deliverables, and different the Navy, and these different databases, so that laboratories can send them directly to the to be uploaded into that database. But in any case, you should work on having a good database so you can streamline your data and be able to call it up quickly and able to put it into your software tools so that you can come up with your results and checking out your results. This also provides you a basic structure for handling that those mounds of data. So let's go on to the summary. So what you've learned today, I just want to go over those things. As we said, we hope that now you have more confidence with your statistical concepts. You're better able to select the appropriate statistical method for your project, and also the software tools that you will use for that project. with Liz and Randall's part, you should be now ready for practical application of the statistics in four areas. In the area of establishing a background, of determining if the groundwater data is in compliance, of being able to do a trend analysis on that data, and then monitoring optimization, being able to say, do I need all this data? Is there more data I need, or can I get by with less data and optimize the data that you need? In any case, we hope that you will be going to this website and using this GSMC document in your toolbox for evaluating groundwater data, making a better decision for your project. And with this, I will turn it back over to Juliana for your questions and the break time.
Thank you, Harold. We do now have time for questions, so you're welcome to send those in using the Q&A pod. I'm also going to pull up a couple poll questions to answer as we're wrapping up today. I do want to remind you about the feedback form. We do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback at this point. So if you're interested in a certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back and check the box. Right now, the only way to get a certificate is by checking that box and submitting the feedback. And I also encourage you to register for Thursday's class on geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites. And we've incurred a link on the fourth bullet here so that you can quickly go over and read more about the class and register. Several questions have come in, and I'll go ahead and start asking those. Is there a difference in calculating natural versus anthropogenic background? And Liz, if you're answering, we're not hearing you, so you definitely need to unmute.
Oh.
So we can hear you.
You can answer. Sorry, Liz, you want to take that one?
Yeah, you can take it.
Okay. Yeah, I was on mute, so sorry. No, conceptually, there's no difference in the methods, but if you think about anthropogenic, there will be probably multiple sources, so it's more likely to potentially violate some of those independent and identically distributed assumptions. So that's one thing to be careful about with anthropogenic background. To some extent, natural background also has some of those issues. But in particular, I think anthropogenic would be, because it's really you're talking about multiple upstream sources potentially in that case.
Can you mix quarterly data with annual data for the Morris-Mandelkind trend analysis?
Yeah, I don't know specifically for Maros. I think Liz might be familiar with that, but I would think that if you have quarterly data, I guess, and then maybe you switch to annual at a particular location, you're kind of mixing additional data from an earlier period, or vice versa. Maybe you have more data later on, so that would seem to be maybe not the most appropriate thing to do. I don't know, Liz or Harold, do you have experience with you doing that test?
On Morrow's, we typically use quarterly data or semi-annual data. Sometimes depending on how far back you're going, you may get one or the other. I've actually, used it before, with both sets of data, and it seems to work okay. It just depends on the site and how far back you're going.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that in the when Kendall put this together, they were sort of looking at being able to miss the specific quarters. If the data does not have any seasonality to it, then there, in theory, it should work that you could mix the quarterly with semi-annual with annual, because it's a continuing trend, monotonic trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess it has to do with more checking for seasonality first.
Yes.
A very common question is predicting when groundwater will reach the cleanup criteria, and projecting the confidence limits illustrates this is high uncertainty. In your experience, have time predictions for groundwater cleanup ever been meaningful?
I'm not sure I've been involved in a project where there's been a projection and it's within some, you know, time frame where we would know the answer being correct or not. I guess, Harold or Liz, do you have an example where that's been the case? Or you have a project where actually there was projection and then it was met?
I've had projects where, looking at projections kind of in the short term versus long term, that the projection either has been met or it has not been met. So it depends, because there's so many factors that, you know, even if you're looking at statistical analyses, there's so many factors that actually go into, whether conditions are being met, and that has to do with, in situ remediation or, in situ bio or, whatever is going on, groundwater flow velocity, things of that sort that, even if you're running statistics on it, it can affect, what's actually going on in the ground can affect whether it meets its projections as much as the statistics do.
Mm-hmm.
If there are non-detects, how is the best way to deal with them?
That's a good question. So in the web-based guidance document, you can look at the different analyses. So if you're doing like in the case of just the confidence intervals, there's the Kaplan-Meier is one method for basically accounting for the non-detects. So in the past, before there were more software tools available, people would just do a simple substitution. And what we found was that wasn't the best method, because if you think about it, then you're replacing what is likely a range of concentrations, just not detectable, with one particular value. And so you're really affecting, the mean and the variance of your data set. And it's the same thing conceptually if you're thinking about trend analysis or any other kind of estimate you're trying to do of your data set. But, that's one of the nice things in the web-based guidance document is you can go into particular analysis, and you can see how you can handle non-detects. So what are the options for that kind of analysis? And it depends upon the analysis you're doing.
Do you have recommendations for guidance on planning sampling when you're trying to assess whether a site is even contaminated and should become a site versus evaluating whether remediation is complete?
Yeah, well, I think there's some basic, data quality objectives and planning software. There's, like I mentioned, Visual Sampling Plan has some tools for that purpose. It depends upon, where you are. You're saying initially you're in kind of initial phase of characterization, and it has a somewhat intuitive interface for, putting in maps and, kind of aspect. It's not set up for groundwater specifically, so part of it is just kind of an extrapolation. But VSP is one software that we have in the web-based guidance document that can do that kind of thing.
Thank you. We are almost out of time for today's class, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up. I know we have a couple remaining questions. If you would like us to follow up with trainers to get answers to those questions, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll coordinate following up with trainers to get answers to the questions. And if you haven't had a chance to type in your question, that's another great option for you. Looking at our poll results, are you ready to use statistics to better understand groundwater data at your sites? And we're about even between yes and need to learn more, and I encourage both groups to follow the link to the guidance document. It is available in the related URL section, also from the main Clue In training page where you started today. It's a great resource that you can use after today's training class. And also thinking about projects that you're working on, thank you to those who